From NPR News, this is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. By this time on September 11th, the enormity of the atrocities was beginning to register. New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani had just returned from his first visit to what was already being called Ground Zero.
It was the most horrific scene I've ever seen in my whole life. We saw the World Trade Center in flames, a big gaping hole all the way on the top of it. We could see people jumping from the top of the building. And then we went into Barclay Street, 75 Barclay Street, I think it was, and we were there when the building collapsed, and it collapsed in part on 75 Barclay Street. So we were trapped in the building for maybe 10 or 15 minutes, trying to get out different exits. We finally went through a basement and came out 100 Park Place.
At that point, we still expected thousands of injured in the emergency rooms of New York. There were numbers about those on board the hijacked airliners, and the mayor was asked the question on everyone's mind, how many?
I don't think we really want to speculate about that. The number of casualties will be more than any of us can bear, ultimately.
On that day, and those that immediately followed, decisions flowed from the events of 9/11. Many of us, from the president on down, faced choices. What to do, what to say, where to go. Call and tell us about your decisions on 9/11. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And we begin with NPR commentator Ted Koppel, who joins us from his home in Maryland. Ted, good of you to be with us.
It's good of you to have me. Thank you.
And President Bush was flown that day from a school in Florida to an Air Force base first in Louisiana, then to the Strategic Air Command bunker in Nebraska, in part because among the many things we did not know was if other attacks were yet to come.
There was so much we didn't know, and in fact, even after the people in authority from the president on down began making decisions, most of those decisions were ones that we didn't find out about until years later. I remember about three years ago, doing an interview with Kofra Black. Ambassador Black was at one point the head of counterterrorism at the CIA. In fact, on November 11th, he headed up counterterrorism at the CIA. And there had been an interview that I heard here on NPR with someone who worked for the CIA in covert operations, who had been called back to duty, and he was called into Kofra Black's office. And he said on one of your NPR programs that Kofra Black said, I want you to go out to Afghanistan, and I want you to bring back Osama bin Laden's head in a box. And I asked Ambassador Black, had he said that, and he more or less confirmed that he had. That was sort of the attitude at the moment, at that time. There had to be, they knew who had done it, they knew who was responsible, they knew the country was going to expect a swift and robust reaction, and much of what happened over those first few days involved things that you and I, Neil, obviously, and the American public simply did not know about. Covert operatives, members of the CIA, special operations forces being sent out to Afghanistan within a matter of days and hooking up with members of the Northern Alliance who were very much anti-Taliban and anti-Al-Qaeda and operating for the next few weeks and months, ultimately with the help of U.S. air power.
And we learned all kinds of words that we're not familiar to most Americans. Certainly, Al-Qaeda was a term not known to most Americans at that time, though Al-Qaeda had declared war on the United States and indeed had carried out attacks against United States interests, not just in distant parts of the globe, like Yemen, but in New York, the first attack at the World Trade Center.
I was about to say the attack on the World Trade Center 10 years ago today was not the first time. They had set off a huge bomb that was carried in vans that were parked in the underground garages at the World Trade Center. And the result was devastating, but clearly nothing along the lines of what happened 10 years ago. A number of people were killed. There was a lot of damage. I remember going into that garage sometime later, and it was as though the place had been hollowed out from the bottom up. But it hadn't had the impact. I guess even at that time, Al-Qaeda thought that they would be able to bring down the World Trade Center by simply, you know, getting the foundations of it. They failed at that time. Tragically, they did not a few years later.
The president, George W. Bush, I don't think there's been an American president for the last 70 years who has not been involved in warfare of one form or another. Yet this is a situation that no president had faced, certainly since Franklin Roosevelt.
And it was, you know, it was difficult. He, on the one hand, wanted to show an outward display of calm, the tempered or maybe anger tempered by calm determination. I have that image, that television image that I'm sure many of our fellow citizens do, of the president at ground zero, President Bush, with his arms sort of casually slung over the shoulder of a New York City fireman. And he said, you know, we've heard what happened here, and they're going to hear us in a matter of days. And he had, by that time, already given some of the orders that would send those covert operatives into Afghanistan. And if I may, for a moment, Neil, I would just like to say that I think that what President Bush did in those first days and weeks, and what he and his immediate subordinates set into motion in those first few weeks, was probably just right. They achieved a great deal during those first weeks and months with relatively small manpower, And with the backing of U.S. bombers, they in effect drove most of the Al Qaeda operators into hiding, into the caves of Tora Bora, and ultimately, as we now know, across the border into Pakistan. They achieved an enormous amount in those first months, and my sense is that if things had been left pretty much like that, the American public and the world at large would have understood that what America did was absolutely essential, had to be done, there had to be a response, there had to be punitive raids that were carried out. It is what followed, whether you want to talk about the ultimate war that began in Iraq, which we were led to believe had some connection to what had happened on 9/11. And which really had no connection at all. The great concern, obviously, was that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which it turned out there were not. And then ultimately, years later, when the number of troops in Afghanistan were cranked up to the point at which today we have more than 100,000 young Americans in Afghanistan, when it is generally believed and understood that the number of Al-Qaeda members is fewer than 100, maybe only a few dozen. So an awful lot has happened over these past 10 years. And I know you and I will have the chance to talk about it a little bit later on in terms of not so much what Al-Qaeda did to us, but what we, in some respects, did to ourselves.
There is that aspect to it as well. Yet, again, raids that would have been in response to what was essentially, in military terminology, a raid against the United States. Not a campaign, not a war, not an effort to start a new front, but a raid on New York and Washington, and indeed, of course, the plane crashed in Pennsylvania as well. And raids might have been the appropriate response in reply to it. Nevertheless, it did go from that. One of the decisions that had to be made, though, was to address terrorism wherever it was. This is what we heard President Bush say in a speech in New York. This was what led to the philosophy of getting preemptive strikes, that this was not something done on a case-by-case basis, but wherever threats were seen to be gathering, and that was a phrase we heard a lot in terms of the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that was what the United States was going to be addressed, because the United States had learned a lesson on 9/11 that to let those go unaddressed was unacceptable because this was the penalty it could be paid.
Well, you and I both, Neil, I know, have talked to a number of people who were high up in the Bush administration and who shared the responsibility for what came later. And what every one of them has told me was that the existential nightmare, and that's the term they used, and if you think about it, it really is an appropriate term, because the nightmare was that the very existence of the United States might be threatened if what had happened on 9/11 10 years ago had happened with some sort of weapon of mass destruction, whether that was biological or chemical or, in the worst-case scenario, nuclear. The thought that if somehow one of those weapons of mass destruction had been involved in the attack on the World Trade Center or the Pentagon or the plane that was ultimately headed, as we now know, for the U.S. Capitol, if that had contained a weapon of mass destruction, it could have done so much damage to the United States, physical damage, emotional, psychological damage, financial damage. That was the great fear. And the problem is, when you're fighting against small groups of terrorists, they only have to succeed once. The people on defense, and that's us in this case, have to be right all the time. We can never afford to fail.
One of the most visible decisions made in the moments after the attacks was to ground all commercial airplanes. Ben Sliney issued that order. He'll join us next. Call and tell us about your decisions on 9/11. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan with Ted Koppel. You're listening to live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News. This is special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. Watching the attacks play out from their apartment in New York City, one couple made the decision to leave and have the children they'd always wanted someday. An options trader in New York said he took the attacks personally and soon after joined the Marines. One Chicago man stepped away from the news coverage on 9/11 and booked a flight to Miami. There he proposed to his girlfriend and was married the following September. Many of us from the president on down faced choices that day. What to do, what to say, where to go. Call and tell us about your decisions on 9/11. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org. And this was an email we received from Stephen in York Springs, Pennsylvania. On the morning of September 11th, 2001, in my role as an attorney in state government, I was attending a meeting of the Pennsylvania State Board of Accountancy in Harrisburg. The board was in the middle of executive session deliberations when the commissioner of the Bureau of Professional and Occupational Affairs entered the closed meeting room and calmly announced that the United States was under attack, that the World Trade Center towers in New York had collapsed, that the Pentagon was on fire, and that a hijacked airplane was currently over Pennsylvania skies. He advised that the governor was closing all state offices and told us to leave the building immediately. As we returned to public session to adjourn, one of the board members, a retired Air Force colonel, asked in an incredulous voice, "Under attack? How can this be?" I told the meeting stenographer to have the minutes reflect that the board was adjourning its meeting early because of a national emergency. NPR commentator Ted Koppel is with us, and joining us now is Ben Sliney, who is with us by phone from Pennsylvania. Good of you to join us today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
And you started your job September the 11th, 2001.
That was my first day in that position, yes.
And you were the U.S. Federal Aviation Administrator's National Operations Manager. And what did your job entail?
Essentially, the National Operations Manager has a responsibility for the safety of the and efficiency of the national airspace system.
And what happened on that morning of September the 11th?
Well, a lot happened that morning, but it culminated with of course, the decision to ground all aircraft and close U.S. airspace.
And, well, you, how did that decision get presented to you?
Well, it was actually an attempt by us to gain control of the airspace, and it was actually a progression that culminated in the land order prior to that. And actually, it was being driven by the events. The event that drove a national ground stop, meaning that no further aircraft could enter the nation's airspace, that was the crash of United 175 into the South Tower. And the precipitation for the land order was the crash of American 77 into the Pentagon.
And was there any way to have changed those decisions?
Well, to change them?
Yeah, I mean, looking back, would you have?
Oh, no, no. I wish I'd have done it earlier, actually, shut down the system. I think air traffic control itself in the entirety of the nation would have reacted much more quickly to the events transpiring if we had any inkling of what was going on. We were pretty much in the dark as to the scope and the origin of these events and why they were occurring. And these orders were the result of our attempts to get our minds around what was going on that day.
Because we'd had experience with hijacked airliners, though not recently, but nevertheless nothing like this.
Indeed, that's true. Of course, my own personal, I started air traffic control back in the 60s and was very familiar with hijack and the protocol that FAA embraced up until 9/11, which essentially was for us to get all other aircraft under our control out of the way of the hijacked aircraft. Generally, those events ended benignly. There were a few notable exceptions, but generally they ended benignly, and it was our job to get every other aircraft out of that aircraft's way, let it go where it would, and it would resolve itself.
And it was not understood by you or anyone else, and there was no way you could have understood this before that, that this was a very different event.
Yes, and the biggest differences were that, one, there was a concerted effort by a group of people, in this case terrorists, and more than one aircraft was involved, acting in some sort of under some sort of plan. And the most significant deviation other than that was that these hijacked aircraft were being piloted by the hijackers themselves. In my own experience and to my knowledge, that had never occurred prior to this time.
There was a movie made back in 2006 about United Flight 93, the one that crashed in Pennsylvania. You were a central character in that film.
Well, yes, they did portray my role on that day, and I played myself, actually, in the role. In fact, we're in Shanksville now. We just concluded the ceremonies today for the commemoration of that crash.
And as you look back on, there must be just tremendous mixed emotions about that day.
If I may refer to today, it was very emotional, very intensely emotional, as they read the names of the 40 who perished on that flight, the 7 crew members and 33 passengers, who were truly heroes on that day and who took control of their own destiny and saved at least some American lives on the ground, I would imagine, by avoiding and thwarting the hijackers' plans.
And as you think back on that day, the American jets in the air preparing for orders to shoot down American airliners.
We actually discussed it that day after American 77 had crashed and prior to the demise of United 93 about whether or not we, meaning America, would actually shoot down a flag carrier containing U.S. citizens on board. Fortunately, that debate was moot.
One of your jobs is to make decisions, rapid decisions, one after another, all day long. That's what your job entailed. Has there been anything like that day?
That was a unique day in my experience, and I think a never experienced before in our nation's history. We've never closed our airspace before. That was a drastic measure that seemed to be the logical step in our attempts. When I say our attempts, I mean air traffic control to get in command of the airspace. Air traffic control is, by the very name, a control, and we were unable to really get our arms and minds around the events and gain control of the airspace. And the sequence of steps that we took, the ground stops, then the national ground stop, and then the land order, those were the means to try to gain control of that airspace, and indeed we did.
When people ask you what you remember about that day, what do you tell them?
I tell them that it was a day of confusion for the nation's aviation system, but also one of remarkable skill in landing of over 5,300 aircraft in a very short amount of time, less than 2 hours. And the skill of the air traffic controllers and the flight crews on that day demonstrates that. It was, to me, just a remarkable thing for that to have occurred. And I'm saying remarkable from the point of view of my profession at that time. Of course, the hijackings themselves were the true story on that day.
Ben Sliney, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
You bet. Have a good day.
Ben Sliney is known as the man who closed the sky. He joined us from Pennsylvania, where he attended today's memorial ceremony in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. We'd like to know about the decisions you made on that day. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We'll start with Melinda. Melinda with us from Reno.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was a student at the College of Southern Idaho that day, and classes were not canceled, so I went to class, of course, in a daze. And the president was scheduled to address the nation from the White House, and so we had asked our professor if we could have the television on or if we could be excused from class to hear his address, and she said no, that it was more important that we continue with our activities as if nothing had happened. And so myself and several other students walked out of class, and as a result ended up having to appeal with the dean to not fail that course.
And did you succeed?
We did, sir. We did. She was ultimately reprimanded for that decision. We felt that it was more important to hear the words of our president than to read a textbook in that moment.
Thanks very much for the call, Melinda.
Thank you, sir.
Here's an email from Kathleen. I'm an American, but I was living and working in Pakistan at the time of 9/11. I watched the event on television. Then early the next morning, the teachers in our school gathered with many parents and community members to discuss how we would deal with the event. Many of our students were foreigners, including Americans. Others were Pakistani. Some were already evacuating. Others had no idea what would happen to them. A dear Pakistani friend and colleague came to me and said, with tears in her eyes, said, "This is the worst thing that has happened in my lifetime." She sat with me through the meeting, holding my hand as we planned how to manage the next few months of our lives. And joining us now is Tanisha Williams Minor. In 2001, a teacher at in Springfield, Virginia, at a high school there. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And this was in Accotink, Virginia?
The name of the school is Accotink Academy. It was in Springfield, Virginia.
And some of the students there had parents who worked at the Pentagon.
That is exactly right. We had two students who had parents who worked at the Pentagon.
So you faced any number of decisions that day, including the decision about what to tell your students.
Absolutely right. I was fortunate in that I was only a teacher at that time, but the adults who received the information were the main folks who had to figure out what information was going to be disseminated to the students and how the information was going to be disseminated to the students.
And you had to decide pretty quickly.
That is exactly right.
And you turned go ahead.
The first thing we decided to do was turn off all the televisions. So the admin staff sent out an email, and they made an announcement for the teaching staff to check our emails, and they told us to shut down all correspondence because we also had adults who had family members who worked at the Pentagon.
And I assume that those students, just two of them, were pulled aside somehow?
That is exactly right. It was a therapeutic day school, so we were fortunate on hand. So the two identified students were pulled from class, and they went into a session with therapists, and they were able to process.
And at that point, well, in the Washington, D.C. area, communications were extremely difficult that day. Cell phones weren't working. It was impossible to drive to a lot of places.
That, too, is exactly right. We felt like we were on an island, even though we were in Springfield, Virginia. The issue was that 98% of our students resided in Washington, D.C., so we all went into a state of emergency because we did not know how those students were going to get home.
Well, how long was that school day then?
The adults left around 6 o'clock p.m. The students left around 5:15, 5:30. The majority of our students were residents of Southeast Washington, D.C., and their parents did not come to get them. So they still went home via bus, but we had to wait to make sure it was safe for them to travel via bus. And what we heard the next day was that it took some of the buses up until 8 o'clock that night to get the kids home.
And then you had to make a decision. How long was it before school resumed?
School did resume the next day, but there were a gambit of decisions that had to be made in regard to our emergency preparedness. So we reestablished a new evacuation plan. Obviously, we updated the phone tree. And again, we tightened our policy around disseminating information. At that time, there were teachers who had televisions in their classrooms. And just a decision to make sure that we all gave a unified explanation to the students was the main thing that we accomplished.
And to tell them the same consistent message. And what was that message?
The message was that there had been an event, an unprecedented event, at the Pentagon, and we were uncertain as to how many tragedies were involved. I think we did not use the word tragedy. We were uncertain how many injuries occurred, but we knew that we were working to make sure that all of our families were safe and that we would work to keep the students safe.
And as you look back, you said you were just a teacher then. You're no longer in that position now. You've gotten promoted.
That's exactly right. I'm now a principal at a school in Washington, D.C.
And should you have to make these kinds of decisions again, have you prepared the decision tree, if you will? Have you thought about the procedures you might have to follow?
Absolutely. It's something that we review frequently with our emergency response plan and with the earthquake that just occurred that I think caught us all off guard. It reminds us of how important communication is and the communication that we give to the students because we don't want to heighten anxiety.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Tanisha Williams-Miner, in 2001, a teacher at Accotink Academy in Springfield, Virginia, now the principal of a Washington Metropolitan High School here in D.C., and she joined us by phone from Arlington, Virginia. This email from Shannon in Oakland. I made the unorthodox decision to become a Muslim on 9/11. The summer before 9/11, I'd been studying Islam and toying with the notion of converting. When I saw the planes hit the towers, I found the creed of Islam incredibly comforting. Regardless of the suspicion and stereotypes then cast upon Muslims, 12 days later, I officially converted to Islam. As an American and now a Muslim, it has been a journey toward a new America ever since. This from Dwayne. I was in the 2nd Ranger Battalion based in Fort Lewis, Washington during the attack on 9/11. We were allowed to sleep in because of a planned airborne training operation for that night. I was one of the first people in the company because one of my roommate's friends called to say we were under attack. The rest of the day, we packed and prepared to go for war. A Ranger Battalion can be ready in 18 hours to attack any place in the world. That order never came that day, but we were ready. My company spent the rest of the fall of 2001 in Jordan waiting for the order to go to Afghanistan. And let's see if we go next to Jim. And Jim's on the line from Portland in Oregon.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I was serving as a marketing director for Marine Corps Community Services in Hawaii in Kaneohe. And I had woken up early to try to get a little surfing in before I went to work and turned on the TV and saw the second plane hit, the plane hit the second tower. And I called my boss immediately. And he said, get into work as fast as you can, because we were responsible for communicating messages to Marine and Navy families on the base. And what was very, just really a changing moment for me was that I drove up to the base, which was normally just a Marine at a guard station who waved you through based on the sticker on your car. And as I drove up, there were dozens of Marines, all fully armed. You had to run through a gauntlet and answer questions. And I convinced them that I was essential personnel and made it onto the base. Many of the civilians who work on military bases were not allowed on the base that day if they were not considered essential personnel. We had to try to get the word out to all of our employees as well as Marine families, and it was just really a life-changing day.
The aircraft that hit the Pentagon, part of the area devastated was Navy territory. Did you have to send any terrible news that day to any families?
Not necessarily us. The Marines in uniform did that. We were more responsible for spreading the word to all of the folks who were involved in the base, and then after that, helping to support further events, which ended up being seeing a lot of Marines and sailors coming back from conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan and attending their services, which became a very sobering couple of years after that.
Jim, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This from Abraham. I woke to the news and watched the second plane crash into the towers and spent the first half of the day watching the story unfold with my college roommates. I was director of a nonprofit called the Humboldt County Youth Arts Program. We had a musical event planned for that night. We all discussed the idea of canceling the event, but it was determined that we should not, as it would be good for people to get together as a community and continue to enjoy the things we enjoy. We did decide to make it a free event and encourage people to come. And Ted Koppel, as you listen to these stories of people who had to make decisions that day, ranging from momentous ones, grounding aircraft, to continuing on to hold entertainment events, the numbers of decisions that had to be made that day, all in new light, cast into an entirely different aspect by the events in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania that day.
Absolutely staggering. One of the things that interests me is that over the course of the time that you've been talking to callers, we've heard in one instance about a school where the decision was made. In fact, it appears to have been made in a number of schools that the kids were not to be informed, that the television sets were to be turned off. And then we heard the one story of the teacher who was admonished because she would not allow the students in her class to watch President Bush's speech. Even at a level like that, you just find it's difficult to come up with the right answer. Should people know what's going on, particularly when you're talking about younger people?
And you're listening to special coverage from NPR News. This is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan with Ted Koppel. Memorial ceremonies around the country and around the world today at a U.S. base in Kyrgyzstan, at NATO headquarters in Belgium, and in a forest outside Jerusalem in Israel. The Colosseum in Rome lit up late in the day in a show of solidarity with the victims of 9/11. Firehouses from New York to Chicago to Los Angeles paused to honor the first responders who poured into the World Trade Center as thousands of others tried desperately to get out. Hundreds of events were set for this weekend. You can listen to NPR's coverage of many of the ceremonies and concerts commemorating 9/11 on many member stations and at our website. Go to npr.org. We're talking today about many decisions that flowed from the events of 9/11. Many of us from the president on down faced choices what to do, what to say, where to go. Call and tell us your decisions of 9/11. Our number, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. This from Linda in Shaker Heights in Ohio. That day, I was at work in a Boston hospital caring for a woman in labor, and I recall being slightly perturbed by how distracted everyone else was. That was my first reaction before we really knew what was happening. But I never looked at the TV set, so many other people have said they were just glued to. I just couldn't look. I had family in New York City. All my Boston friends had family in New York. Many looked, but I could not. And this from Christina. I had moved to New York City 1 year prior to practice my music among some of the greatest artists in the country. My first decision was to walk to my local hospital and offer to donate blood, as well as to interpret for Spanish-speaking survivors. I spent 2 weeks frozen in fear that we would all die on that island any day. I contemplated leaving. But then I decided there was no other place where I could be the artist I needed to be, so there was no point in saving my life. What life? By leaving New York, I decided to stay and to live each day without fear, as at a lavish banquet that would end when the sun went down. I have thrived since that decision. The FBI launched its investigation into the attacks almost as soon as the news broke, and as more information came in, the department's mission shifted. The overriding priority of the FBI became preventing terrorist attacks. Dale Watson was Executive Assistant Director for Counterterrorism and Counterintelligence for the FBI on 9/11 and joins us now by phone from his home in Virginia. Good of you to be with us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And when you learned the news, did you know instantly who was responsible?
Not initially, but after a short period of time we did, and it was pretty obvious after the third plane and then the fourth. So, yes, so we started getting the manifest and getting information in.
And what decisions were you asked to make that day?
It was a very difficult day and remains a very difficult day for all of us. But the decisions were, you know, find out exactly. There are thousands of things you have to do just on one case, be it a plane crash or a hijacking. But then you couple that in with four, and then there were all kind of investigative decisions and matters and briefings that you had to do. So I did not watch much TV at all, obviously, and I worked straight through. No days, Saturdays or Sundays off, all the way through until Thanksgiving.
Through Thanksgiving?
Yes. Thanksgiving was my first day off, as a matter of fact.
One of the things you had to do was set up the Strategic Information Operations Center at FBI headquarters.
Yeah, and we'd had contingency plans for that, and we'd done that before on other major cases like the coal and the East Africa bombing, but never to this scale and never the emphasis that was placed upon it at this point in time. And then I quickly realized the first day that basically the case was over, that it appeared that the 19 people that had done this were all dead. And then, you know, it was a matter of the biggest fear, and the shift was, are there other groups like that are going to strike us? So there was the post-event and then trying to look proactively.
And, of course, you always try to walk it back, how those people got on the planes, where they came from before that, and where they came into the country, questions like that.
Oh, absolutely, and I knew we would do that. And quite honestly, that was going full tilt. But at the same time, what really concerned me was, are we going to get hit again? Are there other groups coming? Are there other planes coming that day? We had a lot of distress calls from a lot of different planes that turned out not to be the case. We had hundreds of reports of other activity going on. One was that the Capitol was on fire and there was a bomb in front of the State Department. So just the normal routine fallout of that was just a tremendous amount of work and effort.
Ted?
I was just wondering what your feelings were and what your views were on the degree to which this was a police incident, which required sort of police activities in terms of discovering what was going on, and to what degree it was a military operation?
That's a very good question. We had always treated terrorism prior to this basically as a law enforcement effort, treat it like a bank robbery, go in and collect evidence and try to bring people back and prosecute them. In this particular incident, I knew that it was very crucial for the FBI to collect the evidence, obviously, and to figure out who did this, at the same time trying to be proactive. But it was very clear Al-Qaeda did this, and then this was not a law enforcement response that was needed, that it was an attack on the U.S., just like the attack on the USS Cole or the embassy bombings. The response had to be different this time.
To what degree do you think that counterterrorism, particularly here domestically in the United States, to what degree should that be military and to what degree is that law enforcement?
I think if you shift it CONUS or domestically, I think that is a protected right under the Constitution. I think you have to be very careful about, you know, using military force inside the U.S., but certainly on a degree of scale, if it overwhelms law enforcement, there are mechanisms, there's laws that you can reach in and use the military under certain conditions. But the counterterrorism effort is not just an FBI, you know, job here domestically. It's for all law enforcement, as well as our foreign partners, as well as the agency, NSA, etc. So it's a team effort. It's a government-wide effort.
And when you say CONUS, Continental United States.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's an acronym speak, and I think we all fall into it at some point or another. At some point, though, the FBI had to work more closely with its counterparts, not just in the military, but at the Central Intelligence Agency as well.
Yeah, and that's pretty much a little bit of a myth, too, because early on back in 96, we, the FBI and the CIA, were actually changing people at the Counterterrorism Center, both centers. I was the first FBI agent over there as the deputy chief and over at the CIA, and spent a good bit of time there. And so that understanding and that flow of information at the senior level was already pretty well established. But certainly as we move forward since then, it's expanded. So a lot of people said, well, the FBI and CIA don't get along. We were pretty much lockstep here before 9/11, and most of us knew what was coming, and we just couldn't get any political will or traction for people to see it.
And looking back, what was the most important decision, do you think, that was made that day?
On 9/11 or post-9/11?
Within the few days thereafter, yeah.
I think it was probably focusing more on not being reactive and trying to be proactive here and trying to figure out exactly, you know, what happened here and how did they do it, and then trying to prevent that in the out months and years. And so I think that was a very, very important decision. I think everyone realized at that point that even though some of us have been saying it, that this is not a law enforcement matter post-event.
Dale Watson, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Dale Watson, Executive Assistant Director for Counterterrorism and Counterintelligence for the FBI on 9/11, with us today from his home in Virginia. Soon after the attack, the Department of Health and Human Services activated the National Disaster Medical System. Dozens of medical assistant teams, thousands of medical support personnel prepared to deploy. Tommy Thompson served as secretary at HHS on 9/11, and he joins us now by the phone from Madison, Wisconsin. Nice to have you today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you on this day of memory and a day of when the world stopped and took notice of what was taking place in our great country of America. I'm glad you're doing the program, and I thank you very much for having me.
And what were the decisions you were forced to make on that day?
Well, I had to make a lot because the vice president was in the White House, the president of the United States was in Florida, and then he's around, and I knew right away that this was a terrorist attack, and I knew there were going to be thousands of casualties and deaths, and I knew there was going to have to be a tremendous amount of health care to take care of the badly needed people that were wounded, people that were hurt, people that were dying, and people that died. And so I immediately declared a medical emergency. It's never been done before. I called my lawyers in at 9:30 after the second plane hit the North Tower, and they immediately started working on getting an executive order that I could sign and authorize me to declare a medical emergency. The next thing I did, I called CDC and said, we're going to have medical supplies and equipment to deliver to New York immediately. And by 5 o'clock that afternoon, we were the only agency outside of the Department of Defense that had got a plane in the air. We got a plane to deliver tons of medical supplies up to New York by 5 o'clock. And by the next morning, we had over 100,000 masks and over 200,000 gloves in the hands of the policemen and the fire department officials and individuals that were working on the Twin Towers. And so emergencies like this require quick action. I took those quick actions without any kind of supervision or any kind of input from the White House. I just decided that it was necessary for me to act. I was the chief medical officer, and I acted and declared a medical emergency, and we were able to get these medical supplies into New York by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, which is pretty hard to believe that day that this happened at 9 o'clock, and we had all that equipment, all the medical supplies and stuff in the hands of the people, New York officials, by 5 o'clock that afternoon. And then by 7 o'clock the next day, we had all kinds of other supplies, medical supplies, needed for the fire department and the policemen able to utilize in their search for victims, search for causes, search for what was taking place. So it was a heady time, but a time for action, and we did it at the Department of Health and Human Services.
A remarkable response, yet the numbers of casualties that we anticipated going to hospitals in New York City, sadly, most of those people died rather than were severely injured. And it turned out that the lingering casualties from 9/11 were the firefighters and officers of the police department and others who were at Ground Zero breathing the toxic air.
And it was not only that, it was the volunteers that came in and ingested that toxic air and have had many kinds of lung problems and kind of breathing assortment diseases that came up, and as well as many things else. And right after that, we had to impress into service our medical doctors in the department, as well as many other volunteers. We had to set up a command post up in New York. And then we also had to get it our veterinarians and our canine forces go up there. And one of the things we did is we had a lot of dogs that were in there that were helping and to assist the investigation. And one of the problems were these dogs were getting burnt, of course, because they would smell some things and they get their noses and their paws burnt. And so we had to send veterinarians up there to take care of the dogs so the dogs could be healthy to help out the policemen and fire officials. So it was a time when the Department of Health and Human Services was really the sort of the epic center for decision making and for getting supplies distributed from our strategic locations around the country into New York.
Ted, you had a question?
Into Washington.
I did, actually. Governor Thompson, it's Ted Koppel. I realize it's easy to second guess after the fact. But in point of fact, the first responders, the firemen, the police, complained bitterly now that the masks that were sent up were just totally inadequate. They complained bitterly about the fact that they were told by the CDC, they were told by HHS, that in fact the air there was not toxic, that they were in no danger. And many of them, as we now know, tragically have died or are suffering from very, very severe lung disease and cancers. To that degree, it didn't work out the way you must have planned it.
No, of course, another thing, it doesn't always work out. The truth of the matter is, how were the decisions made? You know, we had the medical supplies, we sent them there. We had the best that was available at the time, and we sent them up there to be utilized. And a lot of the volunteers, a lot of people came in, didn't use the mask, didn't use the gloves. And there were some, of course, that were defective, which there always are. You cannot have a perfect...
No, I'm...
Nobody knew that this was going to happen. All I can tell you is acted faster than anybody else, I'm sure, would have ever thought possible in order to assist, provide for the assets that we had.
And that's why I acknowledged at the outset, it's always easy to second guess. But what I'm saying to you is the masks that were sent up were generally now, in retrospect, considered to be inadequate. You didn't have the proper breathing apparatus for people to go onto a site like that. And I ask the question not to cast aspersions on what was done, but to ask whether it was corrected after the fact.
They were corrected as fast as we possibly could. And a lot of the masks that were available at that time, you know, nobody ever planned that masks were going to have to be able to filter out all of these toxic things that were coming out of a destructive force that took place when a plane the size of a 757 flies into a building, and the asbestos, the fuel oil, everything like this. The masks were not available because they were never set up to be so. But they were the best that we had. We got them there very quickly, and we responded as quickly as anybody could have ever expected.
Governor Thompson, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it. Tommy Thompson, former Secretary of Health and Human Services, and, of course, a former governor of Wisconsin, now a partner at the firm of Aiken Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld here in Washington. And he joined us from Washington, from his office in Madison, Wisconsin. This email from Brian: the weekend after 9/11, we decided to go on a planned canoe trip to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in northern Minnesota. After a few days on the water, we ran into two guys who'd been out for over a week. We'd asked them if they had a radio. They said no. At that point, my friend Steve and I had to decide whether or not to tell them about 9/11. The two guys still had a few days out, so we decided not to tell them. We paddled on. I'm sure they emerged from the wilderness into a new world. This also from Brother Emmanuel. I was starting my first day of graduate school in Seattle at the University of Washington. I was driving a short distance to church for morning mass and heard reports of what was happening. I sat in the car in front of the church, not knowing the details and in shock at what I was hearing. I didn't know what to do. I decided to go to mass and pray. That was something I could do. I am now about to be ordained a deacon. And this from Adam in Cleveland, Ohio. My mother's cousin perished in the towers that day. I decided, never forget. I will not hate, but I will never forget. Thanks to all of you who sent us calls and emails about the decisions you made on 9/11. We're sorry we could not get to them all. You're listening to live special coverage from NPR News of the events of happening on 9/11. I'm Neil Conan with Ted Koppel in Washington.